of the male and female wasps that I use as a reference. And the x-axis indicates channels that record certain fluorescence intensities, and the y-axis indicates the number of nuclei at those particular fluorescences. This is the diploid peak. You can see that the diploid nuclei register at approximately channel 275, while the haploid nuclei at 275, while the diploid are at 550. I've analyzed 10% of the intersexes produced in this experiment and found them to register approximately 550, and that indicates that they are diploid. I've also analyzed all males produced from days 1 through 7. That's approximately 80% of the total wasps produced so far. And I found among the offspring both haploid and diploid males are being produced. This is the first account of diploid male production in the chalcedoids in the absence of mutation. And these wasps are appearing at an overall frequency of approximately 6%, these diploids, and representing up to 10.7% of the male production on a given day. Since males, diploid males, are known to have greatly reduced fitness, the karyotype analysis I'm performing may reveal a higher percentage of diploid male production that I'm not seeing in the adults based on phenotype due to pupil mortality. So what do these results tell us about Wolbachia's mechanisms of reproductive manipulation? The presence of diploid males and intersexes suggests a much more involved role for Wolbachia in manipulating host sex determination. It suggests that instead of simply inducing gamete duplication, Wolbachia requires a much more involved role in sex determination in order to fully control host sex. It appears that there may be a bacterial density required for gamete duplication that's actually lower than that required for female differentiation, possibly because Wolbachia is manipulating both of these sex characteristics individually as opposed to by one mechanism as previously believed. And what does this tell us about sex determination in the chalcedoids? Three main models have been put forth to explain these non-CSD mechanisms. The only mechanism with empirical evidence supporting it, and the relevant mechanism here, is the genomic imprinting model put forward by Buchabaum in 1995, which proposes the presence of a product in the egg that binds with the sex-determining locus in order to induce the female pathway. Maternal imprinting would inactivate the sex-determining locus and prevent binding so that development proceeds down a default male pathway, while the presence of a paternal imprint would activate the locus, allowing binding and causing development to proceed down the female pathway. The lack of a paternal set of chromosomes in the Wolbachia-induced females has been suggested as evidence against this genomic imprinting model. However, it's possible that this additional interaction required by Wolbachia to induce female differentiation is in fact Wolbachia activating the sex-determining locus in order to allow the female pathway to be initiated. So this actually may lend some support to the plausibility of this genomic imprinting model. To summarize, heat treatment induces sex ratio transitions from low to high male production among the progeny of the heat-treated females, with intersexes occurring during the intermediate days. And these intersexes and some of the males produced are diploid, which points to a much more involved role for Wolbachia in manipulating host sex determination, and also indicates for the first time in this group that the diploid status alone is not enough to induce the female phenotype. I'd like to thank my research advisor, Dr. Richard Stouthammer, and my PhD committee and others, and the Grad Student Association and my department for funding my trip here. Questions?
Questions?
Yes.
What percentage of the natural population of these wasps actually
It depends on the wasp. It depends on the population that's infected with Wolbachia. But these actually, in most populations that are infected with Wolbachia, it goes to fixation. But for some reason, there are several factors that have allowed populations of Trichogramma to kind of maintain an equilibrium of infected and uninfected wasps. Each population has a different frequency. Absolutely, that's what I use for my control.
Mm-hmm. One more question.
Yeah, how widespread is the occurrence of intersexes and other species that have a similar temperature dependent and potentially Wolbachia involved in it too?
In other species of Trichogramma?
Other species of insects? Or?
Well, intersexes can be caused by many, many different factors. As a matter of fact, the haploid males I mentioned earlier, they produce intersexes that are not associated with Wolbachia, although they're infected with Wolbachia. But it's been shown that their intersexes are genetically determined. So there are lots of factors that go into intersexes, and lots of many, many different organisms produce intersexes.
Now, the primary method of control for the corn earworm are insecticide sprays targeted at the newly emerging larvae. And pyrethroid insecticides are the primary class of insecticides used for controlling the corn earworm. In sweet corn production systems, the vast majority of the insecticides used are pyrethroids. And, of course, when you use the same insecticide for long periods of time, you start to see resistance developing to them. And there have already been cases of or low levels of resistance documented in this pest in the southern states that are shown in red. But we haven't really experienced the control failures in the Midwestern states. But in the past several years, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana, highlighted in yellow, we've seen a decrease in the efficacy of pyrethroid insecticides in small plot insecticide trials. And in Indiana, we've also seen some small commercial control failures. So this is the reason for me conducting my research project, in which I'm looking at populations of corn earworm to see if resistance is in fact causing or responsible for these problems. So to do this, I have three collection sites, one in Lafayette, Indiana. And in Lafayette, most of the problems caused by corn earworms are from migrating insects. I also collected insects from Vincennes, Indiana, where there's a small overwintering population, and additionally, they receive migrating populations. And in Collinsville, Illinois, where there's a larger population of overwintering insects, but again, there are a lot of insects that migrate into this area. And then I also obtained a susceptible population from Monsanto to compare my field collected colonies to. So first I conducted larval toxicity trials. I tested third incisor larvae, and I tested 5 doses of bifenthrin with and without piperonyl butoxide. And the reason I included PBO in my trials are because piperonyl butoxide is a metabolic detoxification enzyme inhibitor. So if we're seeing resistance in these populations, and if metabolic resistance factors are responsible for them, we will see an increase in the toxicity in the trials with piperonyl butoxide. So it's just a way for us to gain insights into possible resistance mechanisms that could be causing these problems. I tested 30 individuals per dose, and after treatment, the larvae were held for 48 hours at 25 degrees Celsius, and then evaluated for mortality. And my criteria was if they were unable to make a coordinated movement, they were considered to be dead. I also tested adult insects. In 2006 and 2007, I tested adult males collected in pheromone traps for resistance to cypermethrin. And in 2007, I tested adult males from my laboratory colonies for resistance to bifenthrin. And after the adults were collected, they were held overnight with a food source. And then they were placed individually into insecticide-treated glass vials. And this is a video just showing the process of evaluating them to see if they were dead. And some of them were obviously dead, and some of them that were alive, I used my criteria whether or not they were able to fly for a distance of over a meter to see if determine whether they were alive. And sometimes you had to encourage them. So they're showing a couple that didn't quite make it, and then one that's obviously alive. So that was the fun part of my project. Now I'm going to talk about some of the results. This first table shows the results from my larval toxicity trials. I'm showing the LD50s and the resistance ratios for all of my colonies in 2006 and 2007. And the LD50s that have an asterisk, the asterisk is signifying that the confidence levels in the field-collected colony didn't overlap with the confidence intervals in the susceptible colony, indicating that there's a difference between them. And as you can see, with all of my field-collected colonies, there appears to be, or there is a difference between the susceptible colonies. And then looking at the resistance ratios, a resistance ratio of 8 or higher is considered to indicate resistance is building. And in 2006, there are resistance ratios of 14, 22, and 17 in Lafayette, Vincennes, and Collinsville, respectively. And then in 2007, there's a resistance ratio of 8 and Vincennes. Now this next table is showing the results of the trials conducted with and without piperonal butoxide. The top rows are the treatments that were not conducted with piperonal butoxide, and then the highlighted rows are the treatments that were conducted with PBO. And all this is showing is that in 2006, I didn't see a difference between the two treatments. And then here's the same table, but for the results from 2007, and again, I didn't see a difference between the two treatments. Okay, so here are the results from my adult file tests, and these are from the tests conducted with the field-collected adults. And this is a test that's been used for many years in Louisiana to monitor the development of resistance of corn.